Your spring is about to get a lot more power with the Home Depot. Get gas-like power from mowing, trimming, and blowing with the Ryobi 18-volt One Plus system starting at just $89. Mowing power that can take on a third of an acre with one charge. Trimming power with up to 2 hours of runtime. And blowing power with 110 miles per hour of clearing force. All on one interchangeable battery. Get cordless gas-like power for the entire lawn with the Ryobi 18-volt One Plus system. Only at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This week, Jeffrey Chown has joined me to cover Dany's first POV chapter in A Clash of Kings. Jeff is Professor Emeritus at Northern Illinois University. He's a real TV and film buff. Back in the day, he was teaching a university-level class on A Game of Thrones. I really enjoyed my conversation with Jeff. After that, I include an excerpt of my conversation with Kate Ollie. Kate is at Oxford, and she talks about the difference between castle fortifications down south and forts and villages up north. So I thought that that provided a bit of an interesting parallel between the high towers down south and the Mormons up north, which we talk about in this chapter. Okay, without further ado, here is Dr. Jeffrey Chown. Jeff, do you feel like this is the lowest Danny? Do you feel like this is the lowest point in Danny's narrative?
No, I think it's part of the narrative where we see her skills at dealing with people and being a leader. She's taking this kind of ragtag band of remnants of the Khal Drogo's force. Into the desert on this journey. So in some ways it's a low point in that she's doesn't have as much power as she'll have later, but she certainly demonstrates some qualities that I think are key to her success.
I was thinking, I mean that's that, certainly we have to talk about some of her character development that's kind of set up here, but I was thinking, like, you know, classic Kurt Vonnegut structure. You know, he famously said, there is only one story, man in hole.
In hold?
No, in hole. Like, if, like a, you know, you fell in a hole.
W-H-O-L-E.
Yeah.
Okay, right. Yeah.
In other words, you need a main character with a problem. You need to establish the problem, and then you've got yourself a story, because that person can now dig out of the problem. Now, of course, that's a little bit reductive, but I kind of think here that, you know, here we have, Danny certainly has a she has a very real and tangible problem that she will spend, you know, this next book digging her way out of. But of course, so that's one way to look at this chapter. But what you're saying is that, actually, what this chapter does is it establishes sort of her characteristics as a leader.
Yeah, as I was rereading it, I was thinking she's attentive to who she's working with. She pays attention to who's in the tribe. She gets the story on Jorah. She makes decisions about sending the Night Riders out to scout. She's marshaling the dwindling resources that they have. And I think she's a leader, as opposed to her brother, who started this whole thing.
Right.
Her brother wouldn't have a clue what to do out here. So.
Right. She makes the right decisions in this particular chapter. She seems to be the person that is, she's making a decision based on this comet, and it just happens to be the right direction.
Yeah.
You know, to find the city of Karth or whatever. But that, to me, I hadn't really thought about it in those ways, because I thought, well, she's a child, and she happens to be, her magical thinking happens to coincide with the right path. Maybe she's just getting lucky, but you're also pointing out that she's managing her resources well.
Yeah, I think I like Dany in this section a lot more than I do in later books, I think.
Okay.
Listen, I have a question for you about this
sure.
chapter, which is, I know you've studied the Bible more than I have, but it seems to resemble a bit when Moses goes into the desert.
Yeah, it's a little bit that, isn't it, huh?
What do we know about what happens to the tribe of people that Moses takes out on this journey away from Egypt?
I mean, famously, he's leading slaves, so that's the first thing. And he's sort of there is a miraculous beginning to that event, which, you know, in this case, it's dragons. In that case, it's sort of like the escape from Pharaoh. Other than that, I mean, I guess I'm not sure I see that many parallels. Other than that, you know, she will become a liberator at some point.
Well, she's leading them to a promised land. So, I mean, they're going to Karth, which, I mean, she has a bunch of tangles there with wizards and merchants and things like that. But it's part of the journey that.
You know what? You're probably right. There is probably some Moses typology here because, you know, she told her Khalasar, you're going to serve me differently. You're not going to be slaves anymore. Mm-hmm. If you stay, you're going to choose to stay. So there is something of her liberator muscles that she's already stretched. And there is something magical about her. And it could be that in this chapter, she interprets the comet as something that the gods have sent to show her the way. That's a little bit Moses, right? The fire, the pillar of fire in the desert following.
That much I remember. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So that there might be some parallels there.
Well, I want to develop another kind of weird. I'm always interested in the antecedents, the stories, where Martin goes to stimulate his imagination to write this kind of thing. And I know that as an undergraduate, he was at the Northwestern University in Evanston, excuse me, and he was very interested in Nordic tales and Mideastern stuff, but also Native American history and experience. And I was struck, I did a film some years back about the Black Hawk War, which was in Illinois. One of the features of the Black Hawk War was that there was an initial clash between Black Hawk's band. They were called the British Band, about 200 Native Americans. And they got chased after they lost this initial battle. They got chased like 200 miles over a couple of months across the wilds of Wisconsin. Remember, this is in 1832, so it's very dense foliage, and they're away from their cornfields, they're away from their hunting grounds, and this force of American army and militia are chasing them on this long trail that ends up at ends up at the Bad Axe River, and there's a big massacre there that finally ends the war. But what I was struck about was that one of the ways that they track Black Hawk's band is that there's a trail of carcasses of horses and old people who have died and been left by the road. And so the Americans are chasing the Black Hawk band, it very much resembles what's going on with Danny's force going across the desert, where they're progressively losing the weaker members of the group, and they're eating their horses, and they're trying to find some way to survive as they of course in the Black Hawk case, they end up with a tragic massacre, but finally Danny does deliver herself to the to Karth, and then eventually consolidates her power in the overall arc of the book. But I was curious. I know that Martin was in Chicago for a while, and they had this exhibit down at the University of Chicago of the George Catlin paintings of the various tribes around the Mississippi. And if I ever met Martin, I would want to ask him, what did you know about the Black Hawk story from 1832?
Yeah, so. I think that he has said that the Dothraki are modeled after the Mongols and the Native Americans.
Yeah, that's very
And so
evident.
What you're saying absolutely could be the case. I mean, I guess there are different eras of the Mongols, and of course there are different tribes and eras of Native Americans as well. But the fact that he was, you know, he was in university, is what you're saying, learning specifically about Native Americans in that region. Yeah, you could imagine anyone tracking Danny would see pretty easily her trail, right? You know, she's building pyres along the way, and they're leaving horse carcasses that they have to eat along the way, and I guess one of the babies dies.
Right, and one of her handmaid, the one that taught her about sex, dies out there.
That's right.
It's one of the poignant moments of her flight, I suppose, is that she kind of pauses the journey and ministers to the old woman who eventually dies. But
let me read the synopsis of this chapter, and we'll talk a little bit more about it.
Okay.
Upon realizing that almost certain death lies in every direction, Danny leads her bedraggled Khalasar into the Red Waste. She names her dragons and learns how to feed them. She witnesses the death of two of her company and commands her riders to scout possible cities or caravans. Then, finally, she makes her way to the ruins of an old city, and she survives by scavenging. There, Danny learns about Jorah's lost love and eventual exile. Jogo returns with news of a city called Karth. Three representatives from the city have come to see her dragons. So, Jeff Chown, is there something about this chapter that strikes you as significant or you'd like to talk about?
Yeah, several things, but let's maybe shift away for a second to Jorah, because this is a chapter, we're out there on the road. So many of the Martin chapters are about traveling. Uh-huh. And Danny is traveling. The next chapter is going to be about Arya traveling with Hotspur. And a couple of her people, and they run into a fight. And then there's going to be a chapter about Jon Snow traveling with Mormont's father. But this is one of his favorite devices, is to get characters out on the road traveling. And what happens is that they tell each other stories when they're out there.
Yeah.
And Danny sort of interviews Jorah about why are you out here, and he proceeds to tell her a lot of the story of his background about his two wives and how he came to be in exile. And it's a very interesting revelation about the dynamic of why he's with Danny. And the upshot is that he talks about being a lord at Bear Island, and fell in love with a beautiful, how do you pronounce her name? Is it Lyness?
I thought it was Lyneese, but I don't really know. Yeah.
She's very beautiful, but she's highborn. She's materialistic. She wants her luxuries. And he fights his greatest fight at this tournament. He's in a passion. He actually stands off Jaime Lannister, and they award him the prize for the tournament. And at that moment, he seeks the hand of this Hightower woman. And
He's kind of fueled by his passion for her, and wins the tournament. He does the best he's ever done. Right, he'll never match.
And it's all downhill after this.
That's right. That's right.
His prowess declines after he never wins another tournament. And the implication symbolically, of course, is that this woman is draining him, and ultimately she leaves him and goes off with somebody else.
She has expensive tastes.
Exactly.
Her vision of what, you know, being a lord is probably, you know, based on her Hightower upbringing. And she goes to Bear Island and realizes these guys live in basically a lodge.
I pictured Betty Davis coming in saying, "What a dump! You know,
what a dump! I'm not gonna live. I'm not gonna camp for the rest of my life."
Yep. So anyway, she does not want to be on Bear Island, and right. And he wants to satisfy her, and so he does. What does he do? He sells some of the poachers to slavers.
Right. We don't learn about that in this chapter. He kind of leaves that out, right? But he tries to satisfy her by bringing in a musician and hiring a cook.
Yes.
And then he wants to travel with her so she can spend some time in the South. And of course, it's just bleeding him dry. He's just he has no more money left. So he leaves out the part about slaving the poachers, right? But then
we found that out in a different book. I'm sorry, I kind of jumped ahead. But we do know from this one, though, that he becomes a sellsword.
Sellsword in Essos, and he suggests that he sells her jewels. And she can't
put up
it.
With that. So she's this kind of demanding wife who he's desperate to try to satisfy. And, of course, what he doesn't tell Danny is that part of his journey is that he becomes a spy for Varys,
mm-hmm.
and that's what leads him to Danny. And so that's the
later on key details he leaves out, right?
But I guess I'm kind of interested. This is the chapter. Oh, I left out the one key thing at the end of the story. Danny asks him, "Well, what did she look like?" And he, as he's kind of walking out the door, he's sort of emotionally distraught from telling her the story. As he's walking out of the tent, he says, "I guess she looked like you."
Yeah.
And Danny at that moment knows that he's in love with Danny and that he's trying to replace the Hightower woman with Danny. And so I think that's going to undergird their relationship going forward. So
He doesn't veil it very well. And she, you know, she's 14. She's like, in addition to being on the brink of starvation and trying to figure out how to mother dragons for the first time. And
got to feed them charred meat. So.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, she's in charge of trying to keep this band of people alive in the desert. Now she's has to figure out whether or not she could get along with this older man who's basically professed his love for her.
Yeah.
And she tries to imagine it. You know, she's like, trying to imagine being with him.
Right.
No Drogo. You know?
Yeah, no. She closes her eyes and she sees Drogo. Uh-huh. So it's
no one's ever going to be able to live up to Drogo.
Not really an ideal candidate for a 14-year-old.
Yeah, he's not attractive. He's a big old bear, this guy.
Yeah. Yeah, he's a bear. Absolutely. So.
Yeah, I do feel like it's just one more thing that she has to make a decision about. It's like, all right, I've got an option here. Do I take the option? I don't think I will.
He's also a very useful advisor. I mean, yeah, he's lived good. In Essos, and so he knows a lot of the culture here. He's talked to traders. He knows something of the maps. And so in terms of needing an advisor when she's out there on the road, he's pretty useful to have around, not to mention the fact that he's an excellent fighter, as we'll see often later in the story. So
yeah, and because he does love her, she can kind of exploit that devotion, right? She she needs loyal fighters, and he's loyal. He's probably loyal in a way that maybe she shouldn't trust, but she's what he's what she's got.
Would you say that she's using him?
I wouldn't. I'm kind of struggling with Danny's
motivation,
ultimate motivations.
Yeah.
And here's why. I was just reading the chapter about Theon, and Theon, everyone's got a different interpretation of this comet. You know, the comet, you know, portends war, and some people think that the comet is heralding dragons and all this business. Theon basically thinks, the comet's for me. It's my comet. It's sort of it's heralding my return to Pike as the new heir apparent of Pike. And I was reading that, and I thought, this is the most egotistical guy I've ever met. You know, that everyone's got an interpretation of the comet, and your interpretation is that it belongs to you. That's stupid. And now I get to this chapter, and basically Danny is saying the same thing. Like, the gods put it there for me.
Yeah.
You know, I saw it for the first time when we, you know, in Drogo's pyre, and I think, I don't feel what, at this point, I don't feel about Danny the way I feel about Theon, but I'm a little bit in the what's good for the goose is good to the gander situation here.
Yeah.
Because if it is egotistical to think that the comet is there for you, I probably need to think that about Danny to some extent.
Well, I, when I think of comets, the first thing that jumps into my head is that the Mark Twain story that he was born in the year that Halley's Comet appeared, and then died in the year when it made its, it was 76 years later that it came a second time. And of course, it also comets figure in one of his stories where he's got a, in Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court.
That's right.
He knows a comet is coming, and so he uses the appearance to sort of dazzle the the natives that he's encountering as he goes back to King Arthur's court. Uh-huh. So, I mean, that's my association with comets. I don't know if that's what Martin was thinking about, but you're correct that everybody's funny. Using comets for their own devices. So.
Now, here's the thing we might say with Danny. If the dragons are linked, you know, Martin's whole cosmology is magic, right?
Yeah.
The seasons are magical and the dragons
are magic. There are three dragons, and yeah, nobody can quite explain how she birthed three eggs, but that's the magic that drives the story. So,
you know, she lights the pyre and sees the comet, and so one could say she's right. Maybe the comet does herald the return of dragons in Martin's world. In which case, maybe she's justified to have this kind of reading of the comet. I don't know. I mean, I think that's pretty popular reading. I don't know if it's the only reading of the comet. I mean, it certainly features very, very prominently at the beginning of this book.
Your spring is about to get a lot more power with the Home Depot. Get gas-like power from mowing, trimming, and blowing with the Ryobi 18-volt One Plus system starting at just $89. Mowing power that can take on a third of an acre with one charge. Trimming power with up to 2 hours of runtime. And blowing power with 110 miles per hour of clearing force. All in one interchangeable battery. Get cordless gas-like power for the entire lawn with the Ryobi 18-volt One Plus system. Only at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
It's the Smucker's Uncrustables podcast with your host, Uncrustables. Okay, today's guest is rough around the edges. Please welcome Crust.
Thanks for having me.
Today's topic, he's round with soft pillowy bread.
Hey.
Filled with delicious PB&J.
Are you talking about yourself?
And you can take him anywhere.
Why'd you invite
him? And we are out of time.
Are you really cutting me off?
Uncrustables are the best part of the sandwich. Sorry, Crust.
One of the other parts of this chapter that we're discussing is a very descriptive passage about what the dragons look like, and uh-huh. they're mentioned as having this bright green in their scales.
Yeah, black, cream, and green, yeah. Basically. While we're talking about the dragons, I'll note that in this chapter, she interprets the dragon's life, and here's a quote, she says, "given life by the deaths of her son, Drogo, and Miri Mazdur." Mm-hmm. So three humans had to die in order to birth the dragons, in yeah. Danny's perspective.
And it's almost like a reincarnation or something like that.
Something yeah. like that, or some kind of dark magic that requires a human sacrifice or something like that. I was kind of hoping that they would address some of that in this new House of the Dragon show, because if it takes a human sacrifice to birth a dragon, I kind of feel like that changes how how we view these dragons pretty dramatically, I think.
Well, the House of Dragons, it's like the dragons are promiscuous. They're all over the place. Different people have dragons. Uh-huh. Some have big dragons, some have smaller uh-huh. dragons. But the currency of dragons in this story that we're discussing is that there's only three of them in the whole world.
That's
basically what Dany has. That's why these magicians and warlocks and merchants that she's going to encounter in Essos are interested in her, because she's got these three dragons and that they're a potential for some sort of power shift. But that's basically what she's got that's going to parlay into attaining an army and riches and trying to fulfill her destiny of getting back to Westeros to become the king of it all or queen of the but all.
Well, and that kind of starts a pattern for her, and you don't really see it until these later books, but the pattern with Dany is that she goes to a new city, she kills all of the leadership.
Right.
she takes over. And in this case, I guess this is like a serial killer who's giving, you know, her first taste of blood or something.
Yeah.
She goes to Karth and she realizes that she's been done dirty. And they basically are tricking her. They want to keep her there as a slave and take her dragons and all this business. And they're basically conning her at first, and then overtly toward the end are making a pretty explicit play. And she's able to, you know, use her new trick, you know, her new dragon fire trick, and get out of the situation. And you kind of forgive her for that, but then she does it over and over.
We forgive her, though, because she authentically seems to want to set people free, to end slavery. Uh-huh. And so she seems like she has these positive motives, and she could be this kind of beneficial...
she's a liberator.
What did Dostoevsky call it, in The Grand Inquisitor, the...
I don't know.
Enlightened despot.
Oh, interesting.
So she's ending slavery. Great. Hooray for Dany. But then she becomes so vindictive and so over the top in terms of just murdering and hanging bodies by the road.
Yeah.
And she really becomes kind of crazed with the violence that she is able to enact. So, and of course, that ultimately reaches into when she... has the dragons at full force at the end of the HBO series, anyway, when she sort of does a nuclear attack on King's Landing.
Yeah, and I wonder how that's going to play. I mean, I think you probably just touched on, you know, touched a
nerve.
Well,
I jumped ahead of the novel, didn't I?
No, you're totally fine there. I just feel like most people, if people had to point to one gripe with the final series, that final season, is that they don't like the turn that Dany takes, right?
Yeah, but you see the seeds of it in this chapter.
I do think that you see
in this section anyway.
I do think so. I think you know you have a callback to Miri Mazdur, and you kind of almost have an explanation for her death. Like, her death was required to birth the third dragon, and so you've had the death of her son. You know, human sacrifice number one, you have the death of Drogo, human sacrifice number two, and now you have the, you know, you need to strap the witch to the fire to make the third egg hatch. At least that's how I'm interpreting her reading of that event.
Yeah.
And you almost see at that point, it's like, okay, that should tell us something about your character. Even though she's in a one down position in this chapter, so you're kind of rooting for her to survive, right?
Uh-huh.
You know, she's an underdog, so you really want her to get out of this. I think that you see the seeds here. The seeds here are that she will do what Targaryens do, and that is she will kill and conquer.
It's amazing how he has this elaborate large universe of characters, but that he's able to kind of juggle these themes and these tendencies of these characters through such a long extensive chronology of events.
Now, this also kind of I thought of in this chapter, because I think we're like 12 chapters in and we haven't met Dany yet. This is the first Dany POV in A Clash of Kings. And I was wondering, You know, this was originally meant to be a 3-book series, a trilogy. And I think that Dany's story really suffers from the extension of the series. You know, then
In terms of going to a 7
I think
novel
so.
Series.
The expansion from 3 to 5 to 7 or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
It almost feels like Dany has all of the equipment that she needs to take Westeros. She just needs these dragons to grow up.
Yeah.
And then it's on. It's fire and ice, and they're going against each other. But by extending the series, you almost have to extend Dany's wheel spinning. You know, she's got to stay, you know, she's got to have a problem upon problem upon problem in Meereen just to kind of delay her so that Martin can make this story, you know, wider and deeper. But I almost feel like Dany's character suffers because of that.
I think I agree with you. I remember when I initially read the 5 books, I always felt this guy needs an editor. You're getting too far afield. And, you know, why do you need all these characters over in this section? How do they fit into this central story of Dany and Jon Snow?
Yeah,
and
the later chapters of Dany's are like, you're introduced to new characters that'll die that same chapter. And
yeah. Yeah. And I'm thinking, how does that benefit the overall trajectory of the story? And I just think Martin loves to expand and expand and expand, but at a certain point you got to bring this thing to conclusion. I just hope he can in the next 20 years.
I know it. Yeah, Dany's character, I think more than any other character, I think her narrative arc languishes. And I do think that he originally thought 3 books, here I have her in Carth. I'm going to have her build up strength in Meereen, and then the big battle's on. But it continues to be delayed.
Well, I think clash. In a lot of ways, as I look at the overall story, and I'm very influenced by having seen the HBO series, but I think Dany is at her most interesting when she's in Carth and she's out in Essos and she's traveling and she's meeting these different exotic things.
Oh, that's a hot take.
And she's dealing with the slavers. But when she gets back to Westeros and this whole business about Tyrion being her advisor, I think that's where I feel like the whole thing is starting to unravel a bit.
That's interesting. She kind of has that feeling. It's hard to know if the books are going to follow the series, but when she gets back to Westeros, it becomes one of these things where it's like, yeah, you could. What kind of ruler are you going to be? Are you going to be the kind of ruler who is loved, and does that matter to you? And
are you going to deal with the White Walkers, or are you going to be more obsessed with your own getting on that Iron Throne?
That's right. So, that's right. Are you going to be jealous of Jon when you find
out
his
claim? Can you share with Jon
to the throne? She's almost a little bit in this chapter. You know, at 14 years old, she's almost a little bit even more mature than the Dany we meet in the later parts of the series.
Well, isn't there a theory that when she meets those wizards in Carth, that one of them kind of brings out this worst aspect of the Targaryen genetics in her, this violent.
I haven't read about that one. I'm gonna have to look that up.
I was just reading about it last night, and I thought, oh, that is interesting.
Yeah. So tell me more about that. So you think that this wizard in Carth actually might trigger something in her?
Yeah. There's a. I was reading last night, and I can't bring it all up, but she gets sort of a choice to make, and she touches something that the wizard has imbued with negative energy. And the person I was reading, it was a fan theory about it, is that that is a turning point in her character and explains a lot of the non-egalitarian violent urges in the character later on. Because if you just look at this chapter that we're talking about, she's a pretty positive ruler. She's trying to get these people through. She is making good decisions. She's not particularly violent at this point. But we're going to see that coming out later. Now, if you contrast her with the other central character, Jon Snow, Jon Snow pretty much throughout the story is never tempted to kind of go off on a dark binge the way that Dany is, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, Jon is one of these sort of more classically heroic protagonists, right?
Yeah.
But I will say that it's a little bit Donnie Brasco, where he kind of goes undercover, falls in love with the culture.
Yeah, yeah.
And he literally falls in love with Ygritte and Ygritte and...
I've always thought that the romance with Ygritte is the strongest romance of the entire story, you know.
And it's very clear to me there's no romance in this series that ends well.
No. And that's foreshadowed in this story of Jorah and his romance with Lady Hightower.
For sure. You marry for love, you things are going to end badly for you. I do feel like, you know, killing Corin Halfhand... I think that that does something to Jon, even though he kind of feels like he has to do it.
Uh-huh.
He doesn't keep his vows. He can't keep his vows. You know, that's the one thing that he feels very, very strongly about, is that he's not going to consummate any kind of love relationship because he doesn't want to father a bastard. And then, of course, he falls in love with Ygritte, and he breaks that vow. And you could say that that complicates his character in a way. And of course, at the end, the last published book, the perception is that he has betrayed the Night's Watch entirely by letting the wildlings in.
I always get the sense, though, that when he does these things, he is tortured by it. Whereas with Dany, it's kind of like her ambition sort of overrides any sort of qualms about the things she has to do. And that's the central difference between the two characters, that Jon Snow does not want to sit on that Iron Throne. He's not driven by this lust for power, whereas Dany thinks that she is just... that's her birthright. She needs to be sitting on that thing, even though she doesn't really know the people that she's going to rule. She's not really lived in Westeros, but she somehow thinks that she's got to go back there and rule
everything.
Well,
and I think that let me ask you this question about Dany, because I was reading this chapter and I was thinking, now Jorah leaves out this information about the fact that he was buying and selling people.
And spying for Varys, the two things that he leaves out.
That's right. So he leaves out those two things. I wonder what would have happened if he just came clean, totally clean, in this chapter.
So you're suggesting honesty is the best policy?
I don't know. I'm asking. Because I kind of feel like at this point, he's all that she's got.
Uh-huh.
And he's demonstrated loyalty, and he could just say, look, I started out this way. I can see that you're clearly, you know, the true queen of Westeros now. Please forgive me. I think she probably forgives him at this point.
Well, later on, when she finds out that he was working for Varys, she sees it that technically she should have him executed at that point. But but she decides that, oh, I'm going to forgive you by exiling you. So
again, with the exile.
Yeah, yeah. So once again, he's off on an exile. But of course, he comes, you know, at least in the HBO version, he comes back to her and sort of fights in a sort of stereotypical chivalric fashion. He fights to defend her at the big
In the Colosseum. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I don't feel like maybe she has that taste for vengeance yet.
Yeah, well, maybe this fan's theory about it is correct, that she's going to get corrupted later on. But
yeah, I don't know. Like, I feel like, oh, that's a bad move, Jorah. You should have just come clean. You got a moment.
Yeah.
You got this moment to come clean. And the fact that he keeps the secret is the thing that actually does him in the end. Because what he brings chief to the table, besides his counsel, besides his medal, is he brings loyalty. And that's what she needs. And then it turns out that he's fundamentally disloyal.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't know. I kind of feel like this was Jorah's biggest mistake not telling.
Well, he's very strong as a physical warrior, but there's some... his moral qualities have some weaknesses that result in these kind of decisions, I suppose. So.
Well, and you could say that there's a similarity here. Here he is putting himself forth as something that kind of... He's putting on a better face than he actually has when he falls in love.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, of course, you know, who doesn't want to do that, right? You know, for Lanice, what he does is he comes off as a braver knight than he really is, and maybe he puts himself forward as a wealthier lord than he really is. And then with Danny, he puts himself forward as a more loyal counselor than he really is.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think in both cases, he's motivated by love.
Well, he's going to get very jealous, too, when Danny has a series of sure. paramours coming up here are going to set him off. So
that's totally right. All right. Notable introductions of this chapter. We meet the names of the dragons for the first time.
Yeah.
Rhaegal, Drogon, and Viserion. And we hear about Jorah's wife for the first time. And of course, we hear about this the great city of Qarth for the first time.
I've always found it interesting that she names one of the dragons after her brother Viserys, who was such a jerk to her. And
yeah, she says in this chapter, she says, "This dragon will be everything that my brother was not."
Wishful thinking, I think. But anyway,
yeah. we also meet these three representatives from Qarth, and that would be Pratt, Zaro, and Quaithe.
Yeah.
And, of course, this brings us to one of the key differences in the show, and that is, you know, Danny has to become kind of a beggar at the gates of Qarth in the show.
Uh-huh.
And in this chapter, basically, you know, Jogo comes back with these three representatives who are interested in her dragons. And I will note that the Quaithe narrative is introduced in the show and then dropped completely. You've got this woman with like a full mask on that she meets, and she seems to be someone that knows something about her. And then the show just never picks that storyline up. It just drops it completely.
You love her.
Where are the dragons?
Will you betray her again, Jorah the Undull? Will you betray her again?
Never.
The thief you seek is with her now.
Andy, I'm trying to remember here. In terms of what we just read, this chapter, the dragons are actually hatched because it describes one of them sitting on her shoulder when she's...
Yeah, absolutely.
But when she, in the HBO series, when she gets to Qarth, they're still eggs because one of them is stolen, right?
No, this is so they hatch at the end of season one.
Oh, okay. Right? All right.
She goes into the pyre, comes out with dragons. That there's that image of, you know.
Oh, right. Yeah. When her hair burns off and all that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And then she's got them in kind of these little, like, cages.
Okay.
And that's what they steal in Qarth. They basically steal they ransack her apartment.
They
basically
steal baby dragons then.
And they steal these baby dragons who are in little cages.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But I think they made a couple of interesting choices to shift the narrative with Qarth that really the show does for the first time, because that first season was pretty faithful to the book.
Uh-huh.
And then in this, I think in this narrative with Qarth, you really start to see the show diverge with a couple key details.
Yeah.
Notable departures. Well, we see the departure... The deaths along the road.
Yeah.
We see the old man and the young babe die, and I guess the Dothraki have some kind of belief in reincarnation. If a warrior dies, they create a pyre, but if the baby dies, it has to be reborn.
Well, this chapter has a lot of talk about ghost, and she refers to Khal Drogo as still riding out, you know, as a ghost. And they're afraid of going into Karth because, or no, I'm sorry, that city that they meet along the way.
Yeah, the ruined city is supposed to be haunted, right?
The people are afraid of going in because it's full of ghosts, but I love Jorah's response. He says, oh, there's ghosts everywhere, you know, so what? You know, so Dany's not intimidated. She takes them in, and of course there's fig trees and all sorts of things that allow them to recharge, so to speak.
That's right.
But it seems that Jorah and Dany's power in this small community is that they are not as afraid of the superstitious beliefs in ghosts and spirits wandering about as some of the other people.
Yes. I'll just read this little section here. Other searchers returned with tales of other fruit trees hidden behind the closed doors of the secret gardens. Ago showed her the courtyard overgrown in twisting vines and green grapes. And Jogo discovered a well where the water was pure and cold. Yet they found bones, too, the skulls of the unburied dead, bleached and broken. Ghosts, Eerie muttered.
Yeah.
Terrible ghosts. We must not stay here, Khaleesi. This is their place. And so I think that there's two things that's happening here. Number one, you're seeing that this ruined city actually has enough resources for them to actually sojourn there for a bit. But you also see why other travelers haven't picked it over, because no one wants to be around the ghosts, right?
Yeah.
It's the unburied dead, and that's why these resources are available to her, and no one else is brave enough to go into the city and brave the haunted ruins.
Well, when you see a bunch of skulls lying around, you probably wonder, you know, is that well poisoned, or why exactly is nobody here, you know? So
a lot of ancient cultures believe, you know, this is why you do burial rituals. This is why you do pyres. It's like you have to send people off in the right way or else, right? So if now we see unburied dead, well, their soul is lurking somewhere.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. There's some disjuncture here that would certainly be apparent if you were traveling out of the desert and you come to a place and there's bones lying all over the place. So,
well, thank you, Jeff. I appreciate you jumping on and helping me cover this chapter.
Best to you, Anthony. It's been a lot of fun.
And now Throwback Thursday with comic Steve Osborne.
Have you ever ridden a horse?
I think I've gone on a pony ride at a park once.
Did anyone tell you could pick any horse you want?
No, it was whatever one was next.
The holidays have arrived early with Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale. Upgrading window coverings can be a minor project with a major impact. Blinds.com makes it easy and affordable. Browse premium blinds, shades, shutters. We have your patio covered too. And get unlimited window treatments installed for one low cost. Free shipping and Blinds.com's 100% satisfaction guarantee. Shop Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale now. Save up to 45% plus premium doorbusters. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
This episode is brought to you by Bai. It's Wonder Water. What makes Bai so great? It's simple. From raspberry lemon lime by Sydney Sweeney to Zambia Bing Cherry and Palavo Pineapple Mango, Bai has antioxidants, electrolytes, and no artificial sweeteners. So for flavorful hydration, choose Bai. It's Wonder Water. Learn more about Bai and discover all of the exotic, bold flavors at drinkbai.com.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
So if you're watching Game of Thrones, the original series, do you get more of a sense that Winterfell is closer to the kind of culture that you study, or is even having a giant castle more than what you would expect from sort of, you know, ancient Icelandic culture?
Yeah, so you get some forts and things in medieval Scandinavia, but I think castles are one of the things that are more central in fantasy literature, because the bigger castles come from the very late medieval period. Yeah. Whereas I think they tend to get transplanted into fantasy literature at all stages of kind of fantasy culture development. Kind of big castles are a necessary part. Whereas actually, you know, castles didn't get as grand as something like Winterfell until very late in the Middle Ages, you know, and then obviously some of the really, really grand ones are actually kind of fake castles built by the Victorians.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, with that, and that shows you how early that idea of castles being something medieval begins to take root. I also think in the show, Winterfell is kind of in the middle of nowhere, whereas presumably it would have been more of an urban center. You know, it's the heart of the North, and yet in the show there's nobody anywhere near it. It's just a big castle in the middle of a field. And I feel that socially also wouldn't, you know, Winterfell would attract settlement, surely.
So when I get a sense of like the cultures beyond the wall, I almost feel like that is trying to capture something about how Southern folk would have seen Northern folk. In other words, what you're seeing beyond the wall and the cultures beyond the wall are sort of the worst fears that people from the South have about people of the North. And so then I'm wondering, is there anything about the free folk that strikes a chord that actually does remind me of this particular people group?
So I think Martin is certainly, I would say, inspired by the idea of indigenous people of the far north. And I think he is trying to, you know, he bases some of the kind of tensions off that. So Norse literature is quite interested in some of it, in exploring, you know, how the Norse people viewed the indigenous Sami people. And, you know, there's a great kind of strand of academic research that explores the way in which the literature depicts the Sami people, often in a quite racist fashion. Mm-hmm. And so I think he is inspired by that European cultural interaction that has gone on. I think that plays into his work, certainly. And I think I did a roundtable on Caroline Larrington's recent book, All Men Must Die, which is a kind of, she's discussing the show now that it's finished. And one of the points she raised that I thought was really interesting in her chapter on race at the end of the book was that the indigenous peoples of the North in the show are allowed to articulate a kind of alternative social reality. You know, they engage with Jon Snow and they talk about kind of what is important to them and, right. and their culture and their way of living in a way that the, some of the indigenous peoples of the East are never allowed to by the show. The key difference being, of course, that, you know, Ygritte and Tormund are white and the people that Daenerys conquers in the East are not. And Caroline was really good at kind of drawing out the potential kind of implications of why the show had potentially failed to adequately explore indigenous voices in the East, as well as it explored them in the North, which I thought was a really interesting point that she made.
Right. And I think to me, that's interesting because for some reason, a very Eurocentric view of the Middle Ages is that everything is almost happening in England and France, and that everything else is sort of marginalized. Constantinople was, you don't get more dominant, more as far as it being a fortified city, almost impossible to conquer. That, I mean, from, I guess from one perspective, Constantinople was almost the center of culture.
Oh yeah.
There is a sense in which, because it's so heavily, it's so densely populated, it's going to be difficult to sort of get a cultural foothold there. Maybe more and more difficult to change an institution.
Yeah, I think Dance of Dragons, Daenerys' storyline is all about, you know, the culture of Meereen and kind of trying to reform it whilst also preserving, you know, some of its
traditions. you get the sense that that is a very ancient ancient culture and ancient institutions.
Yeah, and I think, you know, for them, the kind of great rival was always Valyria, which is, you know, now fallen into into doom. Whereas, you know, Valyria, kind of from Westeros' perspective, is just a sort of a great myth of the past. I mean, it really belongs to a time gone by. Whereas I think you get the sense of, yeah, all those cities on Slaver's Bay, you know, they belong to the same age as Valyria, really. And so, yeah, I agree. You get this great sense of their kind of ancient rootedness in a way that, you know, the history of Westeros feels quite a lot more recent. Particularly because, you know, whilst the Starks have been kings of Winter for thousands and thousands of years, haven't they? But we don't really have any conception of what that means in terms of history and what they actually remember, because apart from building the wall, very little is kind of preserved from before the conquest that we are ever told about in the books or the show, really.
Right. Okay. So then I guess with the influx of what we now call Turks from the East, would they have viewed with racial difference in a way that the Sarni were not viewed with racial difference? I'm just worried about projecting a modern racial construct onto onto a culture that was going to be xenophobic no matter what the folks look like.
Yeah, so I'm not a specialist in this area. Obviously, the kind of concept of race is something as a kind of analytical category owes much to scholarship and cannot be always so easily kind of transplanted into these discussions.
That's my sense. Sure.
Yeah. So I think the main sense, I think, in some of the medieval literature that I look at is that the tension between inner and outer is always there. So there is always, you know, you have inside society and that is somewhere kind of safe and protected. And I mean, particularly again in Icelandic literature, one of the key penalties in Icelandic law is outlawry, which means being thrown out of society. So you have no rights anymore. Nobody is supposed to help you. Nobody is supposed to, you know, feed you or shelter you, and you can be killed with impunity. And that's kind of what it means to be, you know, outside of society. And so I think there is obviously a strong tendency in medieval literature for kind of, you know, in groups to be established and narratives are told from the perspective of that in group, whether it be, you know, a particular cultural group or whether it be you know, a particular societal group. And so that is a constant, I think, feature of quite a lot of medieval literature, which these tensions then play into, but it can, you know, it is explored in lots of different ways, including, you know, people who are cast out. You know, the outlaw sagas are a classic example of that, where people are cast out of society because kind of society, they're too troublesome for society. And they become kind of anti-heroes that literature is really interested in exploring, but ultimately will always come to tragic ends, because once you're out of society, death is almost an inevitability, really.
Right, right. Yeah, you don't enjoy the security of the tribe.
Yeah.